In this verse, it is very clearly stated that a kingdom, a state, or an empire must be governed under the instructions of saintly persons and brahmanas like the Kumaras. When monarchy ruled throughout the world, the monarch was actually directed by a board of brahmanas and saintly persons. The king, as the administrator of the state, executed his duty as a servant of the brahmanas. It was not that the kings or brahmanas were dictators, nor did they consider themselves proprietors of the state. The kings were also well-versed in Vedic literature, and therefore they were familiar with the injunction of Sri Ishopanishad, Ishavasyam Idam Sarvam, everything that exists belonged to the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And Bhagavad Gita, Lord Krishna also claims that he is the proprietor of all planetary systems, Sarva Loka Maheshwaram. Since this is the case, no one can claim to be proprietor of the state. The king, the president, or the head of the state should always remember that he is not the proprietor, but he is the servant. So the Brahman is not an administrator by nature. By nature, the Brahman is a detached person. He doesn't feel the need to have many followers, to participate so deeply with so many material affairs. But nevertheless, the Brahmana is becoming the spiritual head of society, because he knows that the Lord's purpose is is actually to descend to re-establish Dharma on the planet. And for that purpose, out of duty to the Lord, he fulfills his Vanashram responsibilities, and out of compassion also for society. And why is the Brahmana more qualified to be the spiritual head than any other order? And Bhagavad Gita, many of the nice qualities of a Brahmana are described. The Brahmana is samo, damas, he's tapas, ocham, he's very peaceful, he's austere, he's self-controlled, and so forth. He's also jnana vijnana, he's knowledgeable and he's very wise. So that means that the Brahmana, he's shastra chakshu, he sees reality in a different way than others. He sees it through the light of Vedic scripture. And therefore, he can make proper decisions based on reality. And what is the reality? The reality is that we are insignificant servants and that Krishna is the proprietor of everything. The saintly king, he may also know that. Evam parampara prapdam, the kings were also educated in Vedic science. But the king, by nature, as a kshatriya, he's less detached than the Brahman. So therefore he accepts the Brahmins as his authorities. Srila Prabhupada said that the best servant, he can become the best leader. So therefore the kshatriya has a humble mentality before the Brahman. Even in the Bhagavad Gita, Arjuna is saying, Shishyashkayam shari mam tvam prapanam, that now I'm surrendered to you, I'm a surrendered soul, please instruct me. So he's surrendering to the Supreme Brahman. And it's only on this basis that the kshatriya, he takes up responsibility to be the executive head of the state. We may think that the kshatriya position is just a position of enjoyment, that he has a big controlling propensity, he wants to exploit others, and therefore he's come into a position of power. And unfortunately, in the age of Kali, this is sometimes based on experience, or very often based on experience, but it's also largely a problem of Atmavan Manyate Jagat, that because we have this consciousness, then we think that the leader should also or will have this consciousness. For example, if you take an ordinary Vaishya and you put him in control of a country, his propensity will just to be to accumulate wealth to keep he and his family very secure and enjoy life. We see in the history of the world there are many examples of this Vaishya community somehow pushing up a leader. And I was thinking that in Cuba, before Fidel Castro came into power with the socialist government, there was a general called Batista. So Batista was more or less a puppet of the American Vaishya community, and he himself was a big landholder in Cuba. And when he became president there, by military coup actually, he imposed very heavy taxation on the people of Cuba, and he took great bribes from the American investors, And he became extremely wealthy, while most of the people in Cuba were living in huts and very near the poverty line. And of course, when Castro made his uprising and forced out this Batista regime, there's many photos of Batista and his family holding suitcases that are bulging with money and jewels and valuable things, and he's racing to his private airfield to get into the helicopter just to save his own personal fortune and get out. And all of the other landholders he just left to the mercy of the new communist government. So you could put a sudra also in the position of the king or the ruler, and then you see even more disaster from beginning to end. But the Kshatriya's propensity for control is actually very balanced, because he's also has genuine concern for the welfare of the people that he controls, and he has respect for the Brahmanas. Even if his duty costs him his life, he'll sacrifice it for the welfare of the people in his state. Not like Batista, but we see in the Srimad Bhagavatam there's many examples of this. King Rantidev, for example, he was fasting for one whole year, observing a codicil, he'd become completely emaciated, but he gave his one prepared meal, he gave it even to dogs to eat, to dogs who were hungry in the kingdom. And Arjuna was prepared to sacrifice his life by jumping into the fire just to protect a Brahmana's son. King Bali Maharaj, he gave up everything to keep a promise to Vamanadev. And I was thinking a very good example was King Shibi, who was performing a great sacrifice. And at the time of the sacrifice, one dove just landed on his lap. And the dove wasn't an ordinary entity, but began to speak to him. And it said, "I'm being chased by this hawk in the sky. Please give me shelter." That's the king's duty, to give everybody who surrenders to him shelter. So the king said, "Of course, I'll give you protection." But then the hawk also flew down, and he said, "My children are starving in the nest. If you don't give me the dove, then you also won't be fulfilling your responsibility as king." So Maharaj Shivi, he began to take a knife, and he said, "Bring the scales." And everyone was wondering what would happen. So he put the dove on one side, and on the other side he said, "I'll give you something else that's equal to the dove." And he began to cut strips of flesh from his own body. But somehow this dove, actually being a manifestation of the devas, I forget which one was Agni and which one was Indra, they were making some performance together to test Maharaj Shivi. And this dove became extremely heavy. So as many strips of flesh he put on the scale, the dove was still much heavier. Until finally Maharaj Shivi said, "Give me my sword, I'll cut off my own head, and you can take my whole body." So this was the... of course that didn't happen. Then they manifested themselves as demigods, and they were very pleased. But the king is prepared to sacrifice his life. And he also knows the principle of sacrifice, that he... I just read recently, actually, that the king, he sinks his individuality into his office. That means that he doesn't have any separate interest that goes against the interest of the citizens. Bhagavad Gita 3.9, Yajnatat kamanon yantra, loko yam karma bandana, taratam karma kuntaya, mukta sangha samachara. So work done as a sacrifice to Vishnu has to be performed. And otherwise work will cause bondage in this world. But if one performs everything as a sacrifice to Vishnu, then you will never incur sin. So the Brahma, the Kshatriya, being under the guidance of the Brahmana and having these understandings, then he's actually fit to rule. Oof, that's already 25 past. We'll continue. Srila Prabhupada, in the present age, the king or president forgets that he's the servant of God. He thinks of himself as the servant of the people. The present democratic government is proclaimed to be a people's government, a government by the people and for the people. But this type of government is not sanctioned by the Vedas. The Vedas maintain that a kingdom should be governed for the purpose of satisfying the Supreme Personality of Godhead, and should therefore be ruled by a representative of the Lord. The head of state should not be appointed if he's bereft of all Vedic knowledge. In this verse, it's clearly stated, Veda Shastra Vid Arhati, that all high government posts are especially meant for persons who are well conversant with the teachings of the Vedas. In the Vedas, there are definite instructions defining how a king, a commander-in-chief, a soldier, and a citizen should behave. Unfortunately, there are many so-called philosophers in the present age who give instructions without citing authority, and many leaders follow their unauthorized instruction, and consequently, people are not happy. So we don't have to speculate how to satisfy Krishna through sacrifice. It's said in the Srimad Bhagavatam, Kalo Nashtraji Shame Shapuru Naka Jnoditaha, that in Kali Yuga people have lost their vision because of the darkness of ignorance. But the Vedic scriptures are actually the guiding lights that will provide them good intelligence of how to proceed. Even from the practical point of view, social organization needs to be very systematic and very scientific. It's not a matter of guesswork or trial and error or concocting some theory and then just experimenting on the people and seeing how it goes. It has to be based on a very clear understanding of how Prakriti functions, of how this material world is working. For example, the Kshatriya, he needs to know some psychology, how to understand the modes of material nature, which person is working under which mode, so he can engage them properly for their purification. He needs to know sociology, how to convince everyone to be cooperative and work together. He needs to know morality and religiosity, keep Krishna in the center and prevent things from degrading. He needs to be an expert in education to make sure that the system perpetuates. He needs to know ecology, economics, so there's no hole in the ozone layer and financial crisis, that the show keeps running smoothly. He needs to know military science and the science of law and criminology also. Chanakya Pandit says that, for example, there are four steps, and every parent knows these very well, four steps to correct someone who's deviating. The first one is vachaha, that just by sweet words you can correct someone's behavior. If that doesn't work, you can try rewards, the bribery method. That's a very popular one with parents also. And if that doesn't work, then you move to the threat. And if the threat doesn't work, then you show the danda. And that word is mentioned in this verse as a synonym. Danda is mentioned as a synonym for ruling. So the Kshatriya needs to know all of these sciences, and they're all nicely explained in the Vedas, and they're all guided by the principles of Dharma. Other so-called sciences of social management, they have some success, but they create many blunders. And so then the people become very fearful, and they lose trust, first of all, in authority, and then they lose trust in God. And because of that, people become selfish and independent-minded, and they develop this shortage mentality, very kripana, that they have to gather things just for themselves, and they can't trust the state, they can't trust each other, and cooperation breaks down in society. A very pious person, when disaster strikes, they may take shelter of God. But for most people, they need a stable basis of at least the minimum economic security before they trust enough to actually surrender to authority and surrender to God. Srila Prabhupada continues with some statements about communism. So he was writing before the fall of the Russian regime, but even today communism is still, with some modifications, it's still prevalent in China and South America, some places also, new socialist governments. The modern theory of dialectical communism, set forth by Karl Marx and followed by communist governments, is not perfect. According to Vedic communism, no one in the state should ever starve. Presently, there are many bogus institutions which are collecting funds from the public for the purpose of giving food to starving people. But these funds are invariably misused. According to Vedic instructions, the government should arrange things in such a way that there will be no question of starvation. In Srimad Bhagavatam, it's stated that a householder should see to it that even a lizard or a snake does not starve. They also must be given food. In actuality, however, there's no question of starvation, because everything is the property of the Supreme Lord, and he sees to it that there's ample arrangement for feeding everyone. And the Vedas, the Katha Upanishad 2.2.13, it said, Eva Bhagunam Yovidhati Kaman. I think that means that the one is feeding the many, that everyone depends on Krishna. Prabhupada said, the Supreme Lord supplies the necessities of life to everyone, and there is no question of starvation. If anyone starves, it's due to mismanagement of the so-called ruler, the governor, or the president. So even though these are strong words, we can actually see that Srila Prabhupada's compassion is manifesting here. That he's a brahmana, he's a pure devotee. For he himself, he's not concerned about whether there'll be food one day or food the next day. But he's very concerned about the world situation. Prabhupada was on the roof of the building in Mayapur, and looking down, he saw some village children fighting with dogs amongst the leftover plates after a feast, and Prabhupada began to cry. So out of compassion, actually, he's saying these strong words. He's worried about people in the world because he understands that Krishna's mission is to re-establish Dharma. Therefore, he's criticizing very heavily even people who are trying to do good. For example, in the world today, the charities, it's well known. Many charities, they collect money for third world countries where there's hunger. And more than 80% will go on different inflated administration costs, including bribes to the people in those local countries just to get the food in. So that's very unfortunate. The worst cheaters who are collecting money on behalf of the people and not using it for the proper purpose is the government, of course, who have a big taxation department. And from very early days, taxes were always being misspent. Maybe this story is too long, but there is a good story. I heard it from Sahotra Swami. So he said that in the Middle Ages in Transylvania, there was a ruler that everybody is aware of, Count Vlad. So he became famous later as the Count Dracula of literature. But Count Vlad was a real person. He was known as Vlad the Impaler, a very cruel king. And he had very strong taxation. So he conquered a new area, probably part of Romania or some bordering area. And he sent in soldiers along with tax collectors. And when they came to one village, the people were very independent, and they said, no, we've heard many bad things about Vlad, we refuse to give any money. So when they reported back to the palace, the count sent the message that, he sent a certain strategy anyway. So the tax collectors went back and they said, the king's very pleased with you, he says that you're very intelligent, and he's personally going to come and explain to you his whole economic policy, and he'll collect the tax at that time. So the villagers felt very flattered. And they said, we can't have the king here, it's just mud on the street and a very simple village. And they said, we've already thought of that, we're going to build you a very nice meeting house. So for a few weeks the work went on and they built a big wooden construction, a very beautiful meeting house. And on the day that Count Vlad was supposed to arrive, all of the villagers were all gathered together, the young men, the women, the children, the grandfathers, and they were all in the meeting house. And the soldiers came, they closed the doors, they nailed all of the windows shut, and they set the whole thing on fire. So this was the taxation system of Count Vlad. Also in the Soviet Union, Stalin was taxing very heavily the kulaks. They were the Hare Krishna Shishi, what have been asked about? So the kulaks were wealthy landowners. People became very envious of them, but actually they were the backbone of production in the country, the kulaks. So he sent out soldiers and just any ragtag bunch of people to actually raid all of the farms. And when the kulaks heard this was happening, that they were being taxed everything from their farm by force, they would have a feast and a party, and then they would destroy everything. They'd kill every animal, burn all of the crops in the fields out of frustration. And then there was a huge famine descended on the Soviet Union. So modern taxation isn't much better. They're wasting huge amounts on defence. America's defence budget, if I remember rightly from about 3 or 4 years ago, it was equal to the defence budget of every other country in the world put together. Which is probably explains something of the difficulties in America. Yeah. due to mismanagement also and ignorance, people are trying many theories that just don't work when it comes to social organization. In China, Mao had the idea that he would push up agricultural production and make more prosperity. But he took some concocted idea from one of Stalin's scientists called Lysenko. Lysenko was a geneticist, and he said, by certain breeding techniques, we can get plants producing more and more. So Mao tried some new seeds. He destroyed the old seeds. And he started double planting very intensively rice crops. And of course, the rice crops would grow for some time, then they would die in the fields. So the farmers, they changed everything. They took out half of the crops and they planted them somewhere else, and then it would grow normally. But when Mao came to inspect, he wanted to see that it was double planting. So the peasants in the night, they had to gather up all of the rice from one field, double plant it for Mao's inspection, and then afterwards they would have to rip it all up again and plant it back in the other field. It was just foolishness. He decided that sparrows were stealing seeds, you know, from his rice crop. Therefore, he had a mass program over one whole province, an experiment to kill sparrows. And within a short period of time, there was such a terrible plague of insects that the birds weren't eating any insects. Then the entire crop of this province was finished, and there was mass starvation. Millions of people actually were hungry in China. So the capitalists, they have a different system. They overproduce just to, and then even though they've overproduced, then they hold back the production to increase the price, and there's silos of food rotting. We've seen some of it in our kitchens. And otherwise they dump it in the sea, and it's a very artificial system. We have to contrast that with Vedic communism. So Vedic communism, everyone knows that Krishna is the proprietor. Prabhupada quotes the verse, Ishavasyam Idam Sarvam. And with Krishna in the center, everyone's mind and senses become so purified that there's no artificial push for sense gratification. So everyone just takes their quota. And in the Indian village, we see that it's very nice. There's local economic security. There's no big transport system, no refrigeration. So whatever is produced locally, the farmers, they have to sell it. And so, or they have to barter it. And so therefore people get things for a good price. And there's local fresh produce available at the time of the year in different varieties, according to what's healthy for the season. Nature produces those vegetables. And there's less stress because you don't have to think what to have for breakfast. There's only one thing that's actually in season. So life is very simple, but because you worship in Krishna, you don't get agitated by, you know, at the supermarket, maybe there's three rows just of different types of breakfast cereal. Right? And in the village, you don't find it. It's just one or two items, and you can choose between those. Also, in Vedic communism, people accept the authority of the leader. It's not a headless society, but there's a basis of trust. And so you'll find in these simple agricultural, God-centered societies that there's a lot of cooperation and good feeling. When the crop is ready, all of the extended family and village members, they come and they harvest one person's field, and then they have a festival, and then they move to someone else's property and they all help doing the same tasks, whether it's planting or whatever. And there's very close bonds. Everyone knows their place. They know their relationship with each other, with the earth and with God. So there's no identity crisis in these simple situations. Srila Prabhupada sums up in this last paragraph. What is the actual qualification then? Who are the only qualified people to lead? He says, it's clear therefore that a person who is not well versed in the Vedic injunctions, Veda Shastra Vid, should not run for election as a president, governor, etc. Formerly the kings were Rajarshis, which meant that although they were serving as kings, they were as good as saintly persons, because they would not transgress any of the injunctions of the Vedic scriptures, and they would rule under the direction of great saintly persons and Brahmins. According to this arrangement, modern presidents, governors, and chief executive officers are all unworthy of their posts. Don't put this on the website. because they're not conversant with Vedic administrative knowledge, and they do not take direction from great saintly persons or Brahmanas. Because of his disobedience to the orders of the Vedas and the Brahmins, Prithu Maharaj's father King Vena was killed by the Brahmanas. Prithu Maharaj therefore knew very well that it behooved him to rule the planet as the servant of saintly persons and Brahmanas. So, the Brahmins were representatives of Krishna. They don't tolerate mismanagement. Krishna doesn't tolerate it if a Kshatriya begins to abuse his position. And we see that many kings and leaders are actually pulled down. Either the Brahmins will do it, like in the case of King Vena, or otherwise, if there's no Brahmins to do it, then the citizens themselves will actually rise up and pull down the king. And sometimes they're artificially agitated by enemies of the regime, and it becomes very violent and bloody. I mean, just a less bloody example, but in the time of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, the citizens rose up in a civil disobedience movement and challenged King Kazi, the Chan Kazi. But in recent times, it's becoming much less civilized. We see the French Revolution, which happened just nearby. People so dissatisfied that they slaughtered many of the aristocracy quite mercilessly. And if the citizens can't rise up and get rid of a bad ruler, then Krishna will make some arrangement with the material energy that he's pulled down anyway. And also very unfortunately, we see that the whole royal family of Nepal recently were, almost all of them were assassinated by one of their own members. And King Gyanendra, who was left, he was unable to be a better ruler than the previous king. And by a political coup, he was also removed. I don't know if the present government is doing any better, unfortunately. But it's for the king's own benefit and for the benefit of the citizens and the benefit of everybody in society, actually, if he can do his duty properly. And what's the result? What's the actual benefit? Prabhupada describes Bhaktaram Jagitapa Sam Sava Loka Maheshwaram Suradam Sarabhutanam Yapamam Shanta Richate. That if you're in full consciousness of me, if you know me to be the Supreme Lord of all planets and demigods, the beneficiary of all sacrifices and penances, the supreme well-wisher and friend of all living entities, then you'll actually feel peaceful from the pangs of material miseries. And with that situation of peace, then you can proceed forward in devotional service and become fully God-conscious. So sometimes we hear all of these purports and descriptions like that are about social organization and governance and Varnashram Dharma, basically. And we wonder, how is this relevant for us as devotees? Because apart from some rare situations, we don't have much influence with the leaders of society. Prabhupada said different things at different times about how we can help to rectify the situation. Sometimes he said if we preach very nicely, we may have influence with the leaders. He said sometimes as a grassroots movement that ISKCON can help the world, that in a democracy people who have become educated by his books, they'll actually demand a proper leader. And he said basically that if all else fails, then ISKCON should provide the example, at least, that for our own benefit and for the benefit of society who's looking on, we should try to implement Varnashram in our own society. So many times we have some imagination of what implementing Varnashram might mean, and certainly it's very complicated, but it could begin just with becoming ideal in our own ashram and our own service, our own varna. So if we're a householder, if we're a brahmachari, if we're a vanaprastha or sannyasi, then we behave ideally. Or if we're performing service as a pujari, or we're working and supporting our family, if we're and contributing to the temple in that way, we do it in a very ideal way. So this is Varnashram Dham. And also that we remember who is the proprietor. We always consider ourselves very humble, and we take advice from the Vedic scriptures. So this is some application for us of the principles that King Prithu followed in regard to the four Kumaras.
So I think we'll have to finish because it's 8:45. Unless anybody has some comment on good governance and Kshatriya Dharma, Raja Dharma. Okay. Srimad Bhagavatam Ki Jai.
Ki Jai.
Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai.